Republicans to wake up. Is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Nice going. You have successfully downloaded and are listening to the latest in-depth interview podcast from me at peterbcollins.com. And I'm grateful that you've found us and you're taking the time to listen. Today, we'll reward that effort with an in-depth interview with the filmmaker who has produced the story of the life and death of Aaron Swartz. The film is called The Internet's Own Boy. And I think you'll find it fascinating to hear how this young computer phenom, Aaron Swartz, helped develop things like Wikipedia, Reddit, the RSS feed, the Real Simple Syndication that you used in order to connect up with this podcast. It is quite a legacy, and it's tragic that he took his own life at the age of 26 as he was facing a huge indictment on federal charges. You'll hear the full story coming up here with the filmmaker in just a moment. But first, we like to roll the credits here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. People like James Hallwell, Robert Byrd, Michelle Pasco, and a new subscriber, I hope I get your name right, Samadu Yahaya, just took out a new subscription and pays more than the minimum. I want to thank you one and all and invite others to join up with you to support this work. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You follow the link that says sign up. It's under my picture on the homepage. That takes you to a page where you get to choose from $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S. of A. get bonus gifts like John Dist's CD called Red Flag, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans while they last from our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. I do appreciate the support that listeners give me, and we'll continue to do this as long as you continue to support me. Thanks so much. Aaron Swartz was an evangelist for internet and information freedom, and in his 26 years, he made quite an impact. It's recapped in a new film called The Internet's Own Boy. Well, Aaron Swartz wanted to change the world, but he didn't leave it up to the rest of us. He took on a lot in his brief lifespan. Brian Knappenberger is a talented filmmaker who has just released The Internet's Own Boy, and it is a powerful look at the life of Aaron Swartz. Brian, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You have produced other important documentaries about the hacktivist group or non-group Anonymous, about the war in Afghanistan, and also about Ukraine. What drew you to the story of Aaron Swartz?
I was drawn to the story of Aaron Swartz for a lot of reasons. One is with kind of just the personal story, what he went through, the kind of moving, compelling, inspiring, and, you know, obviously ultimately a kind of tragic personal story. But also the kinds of things that he was, the sorts of things that he was involved with, I think are really relevant to the modern age. So it gave us gave me a chance as a filmmaker to dive into a lot of things like NSA surveillance, the way we use information, the way and abuse information today, and the way we kind of marry our massively networked lives with more traditional things like freedom of speech, freedom of expression, civil liberties, human rights, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And quite appropriately, you open the film by acknowledging his death. And he took his own life at the age of 26 as he was facing an obscene prosecution over his decision to copy and release some information at MIT. And we'll get to that a little bit later in the story. But for listeners who don't know that much about Aaron Swartz, many people responded quite dramatically to his death. And it really made me sorry that I had never met him, never had contact with him. And as you portray him in the film, I feel that even more strongly, honestly.
Yeah, remarkable individual. Did an incredible number of things in a very short period of time, very short life. One quick thing, he didn't actually never release the material that he that he downloaded from JSTOR through MIT.
That's correct. Yes.
Never actually released it. So he was facing charges that were against him for access to that database. But he was arrested before he had done anything with that information.
Yeah, that's a good point of correction. Thank you. And there is some remarkable footage that you got from family videos that enabled you to depict the young Aaron Swartz, who clearly was a genius and a digitally oriented guy from a very early age.
His family shared. I was lucky enough to have them share with me a bunch of footage that they had shot of him as a kid, including some of him on a computer and programming all kinds of stuff. Which is what he kind of took to at a very young age. In the film, we talk about how he developed a site called theinfo.com, which was a place where people could go and kind of put information and other people could come and correct information on a certain subject, which was a lot like Wikipedia, a long time before Wikipedia existed.
He later spent a summer, I guess, as an intern at Wikipedia here in San Francisco at the Presidio.
That's true.
I will just acknowledge that for this interview, I pulled up his Wikipedia file just so that I could refresh my memory of the different things that he accomplished. And I recommend it to people. Go ahead and go to Wikipedia and be sure to spell Swartz correctly. It's S-W-A-R-T-Z. And you can pick up a lot of the details that we're going to be discussing here today. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so he was also a contributor to a lot of the kind of programming working groups that were working on standards of information flow on the early internet. One of which was RSS working group, and there's a funny part of the film where the people he was working with basically invite him to come to a kind of face-to-face meeting. You know, they wanted to meet this colleague that was kind of holding his own and contributing so much to this group. And he says, I don't know if I can go to the meeting. I'm only 13. I'm not sure if my mom is going to let me. of course, everybody, didn't know that. I was shocked and then just wanted to meet him even more. So there's a sense that he was a big contributor to those early working groups and a real innovator from a very young age.
And there are other remarkable aspects of his early life. He didn't like the structure of school, and so he was self-taught. He enrolled at Stanford, but that apparently wasn't compelling enough to carry him to graduation. And frankly, I identify with that. I'm still a few credits short of college graduation.
Well, you're in some pretty good company. I mean, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, others. I think Aaron was frustrated with school and just kind of saw it as a busy work, a way to pin students together, and really was motivated to learn on his own.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, I've been podcasting now for just a little over 5 years, and none of this would be possible without RSS, Real Simple Syndication. My listeners get the podcast from iTunes, from Stitcher, from TuneIn, from other platforms, including my own website. And most of them rely on this programmed feed so that when I post a new podcast, they are alerted through whatever widget they are using. Hey, there's a new podcast and you can listen whenever you want. And RSS is a tool that has enabled what I do and so many other forms of you know, internet publishing with notification to interested users.
That's exactly right. It's a perfect example of a place where he was innovative. He was a big part of that early working group that worked on RSS. And as I said before, a huge contributor at a very young age. Kind of remarkable, actually. But that shows you his perspective, even as a teenager.
We're talking with Brian Knappenberger. He is the director, screenwriter, executive producer of this new film about the life of Aaron Swartz called The Internet's Own Boy. And, Brian, when we look at how early in his life he became such a powerful contributor to the open source movement on the Internet, to the evangelism around the whole idea that information should be free. There shouldn't be artificial barriers, whether it's 8 cents a page to get public documents from the federal government, or mm-hmm. things that are considered by some people to be proprietary or even secret. But he was really very focused on, you know, opening up the doors and making, you know, the model of the public library the model of the public internet.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, he was particularly interested in those things that really should be kind of in the public domain anyway. You know, the 8 cents a page you mentioned is it's speaking to one of his early, I guess you'd quote unquote hacks, or although I certainly use that term loosely, an effort that he made with PACER, public access to court electronic records. This is where the documents of our court system lie, which is to say, this is where the interpretation of our laws in the United States lie in the records that are generated by our court system, that are generated by with public funding, with public, you know, public government funds. So you know, there's a very strong belief among open access folks that stuff should be open to the public, should be available to the public. It's really one of the only ways we know how our laws are being, you know, how they're being interpreted in the courts. So they were upset that these things are behind paywalls. You know, as a journalist, I use PACER, and it's an awful database. You know. Terrible programming. It's hard to use. You got to pay 10 cents a page. It's a mess. And, you know, it's our law. Democracy laws should be free. So Aaron took advantage of a system where they opened it up in a handful of libraries, downloaded a bunch, and put them online, and got in trouble with the FBI and got in a little trouble for it. Ultimately, the charges were dropped, but really, the point is very strong, and I think most people would agree. It's like, you know, these documents are created with government money. They are in the laws of the land, and we have a right to be able to see them. It was that kind of thing, I think, that in which he was the most upset.
And, Brian, from everything I can tell, Aaron was not motivated by partisan politics. And I want to just offer you a kind of wild-ass example here, a comparison. There's this guy named James O'Keefe, who is a protege of Andrew Breitbart. And he does these video setups where he will create situations that didn't really exist. He will selectively edit. And most famously, he created videos that were used to bring down the community service group called Acorn.
Yeah.
And as part of that, he posed as a telephone serviceman and got access to the office of United States Senator Mary Landrieu in New Orleans. And he was not there to try to share information with a hungry public. He was trying to get information that he could use in a devious way for political gain. And I just offer him as a kind of darkest example, because Aaron Swartz didn't embrace any of those motives in his work, did he?
No, not at all. Quite a counterpoint, actually. James O'Keefe is sort of pulled off these kind of stunts in these ultra-partisan kind of ways. I think the types of things that that Aaron did, he seemed to be interested and motivated by data, by big data sets, by really analyzing problems that he saw in the world, and then trying to bring his skills towards solutions to those problems, and then finding interesting, innovative ways to implement those solutions, and then measure the result that these techniques would have on the problem. He had a very kind of analytical approach to things and to changing the world that turned out to be pretty effective in a couple of great examples. So, I think it's funny that he's facing such it's awful that he was facing such a kind of legal nightmare for what he was doing, because you look at that approach and it's obviously in so many ways the kind of thing you want to emulate.
Well, and if I can just extend this bizarre comparison a little further, James O'Keefe calls his operation Project Veritas, which is the Latin word for truth, and I choke on that to start with. But
I'm a filmmaker, so cinema verite, it's already you already got me at odds there too.
Right. So O'Keefe got a slap on the wrist. I think he got probation for what he did in New Orleans, and he continues to make extremely biased pieces of video. And Aaron, who was not attempting at this point, he did have, political activism later, and we'll talk about that. But his motivation was to provide access for people, not to grind an axe for a particular outcome. And he really wanted people to be able to find the truth in the various sets of data that are often secured from public view.
Yeah, I think that's true, although he certainly was an advocate for things that he cared about, certainly. And I think even in the case of James O'Keefe, I support a sort of broad interpretation of freedom of speech, even among those people like James, which I would disagree with pretty strongly. But I do think... Aaron advocated for things that he believed in, but it seemed to me, reading through his blogs and his writing and the kinds of cases that he was making, that he certainly did the work to back it up too. When he brought a case, right or wrong, he had a reason for believing what he believed, and it usually involved deep analysis.
One of Aaron Swartz's mentors, who is featured prominently in the film, is Lawrence Lessig. Larry Lessig was a professor at Stanford and is now at Harvard. But he has been very active in his own public commentary about the future of the Internet. He, at one point, was considering running for Congress from the Bay Area while he was still at Stanford, and he got elbowed out of the way by Jackie Speer, who's a pretty good representative, but I didn't like the politics of that maneuver. I would have loved to see Larry run. Talk a little bit about their relationship and some of the issues they worked on, related to Creative Commons.
Well, their relationship, Larry actually, after Aaron died, called Aaron a mentor. Here's this guy who's kind of, internet luminary at that point, who basically got partnered with Aaron in creating the... Aaron worked on the technical architecture for Creative Commons. Larry's kind of a great effort. But it is telling that Larry called Aaron a mentor. And actually credits Aaron with the direction that Larry's involved with now, which is really working hard to take the influence of money out of politics. Larry is working on this effort called the Super PAC to end all super PACs, which he's earning lots of money to try to out-lobby the lobbyists and really push the effort for campaign finance reform, which obviously is a really, really critical part problem in our system right now.
Well, and Brian, I'll just tell you that I had that idea first in 1992. Yeah, yeah. I was fired from a radio station in San Francisco because I hatched a scheme to set up a death pack, a Death Star pack. And the idea was that we were going to raise money and only give it to candidates who would agree to advocate for an end of political action committees.
That's pretty much what Larry's doing. I mean, it's certainly in the same spirit.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, that's the effort right now. He's raising money. He just raised $1 million. He's on the way to raising another five, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great effort. And you know, he credits Aaron with sort of starting him down this road, getting him away from his earlier battles that had a lot to do with copyright and that sort of thing online, into this kind of broader battle of money and infecting politics.
Mm-hmm. And talk a little bit about Aaron's involvement in the creation of the website Reddit, which is a user forum that takes all of the different posts that people put up, categorizes them, and then ranks them so that you can go there easily and look at different subject categories and see what issues or topics are getting the most comment at a given day or moment.
Yeah, it works extraordinarily well, actually. One of the most popular social news sites on the, maybe the most popular on the web. His contribution to that is interesting. I mean, he was involved with the kind of famous Paul Graham Y Combinator series early on. And Aaron created a site called Infogami, which was a tool to make other websites. And Infogami didn't get the traction that he was hoping for. And I think Alexis Ohanian and Steve Huffman from Reddit were teamed up with Aaron in a kind of remake of the Reddit site, and they are all sort of thought of as the co-founders of Reddit for that reason. Aaron came in and reprogrammed it, and so you know, which was a big deal. He actually changed programming languages, which became a huge discussion topic on Reddit, which got a lot of users to Reddit, and it was a big deal, and they sat and they watched the users grow and got more and more popular, and pretty soon they sold that. Condé Nast became interested, bought it, and Aaron moved to San Francisco after becoming a very rich 19-year-old.
And do you happen to know, one of the things that Reddit has recently become somewhat infamous for was the posting of revenge porn videos.
Mm-hmm.
Did he have any role in that, or did that occur after he left?
Oh, no, this is long after he left. But you know, it's safe to say that Reddit has always kind of lived on the edge of chaos. You know, there's a mentality, maybe it's a hacker mentality, or an internet mentality in some of these sites where, you know, that prizes kind of openness and expression. We talk about this a little bit in the film, that it's always kind of sat on that edge of chaos where there's been, on the one hand, very, you know, big, interesting, high-minded discussions. Even Barack Obama did an AMA, read an AMA at one point. And at the same time, this other use for it, you know, this notion that hackers create these platforms that can have this very, very, or at least start out as these kind of broad platforms for expression.
Mm-hmm. And Aaron also had the vision for an open library online, which we see evidenced now by the Internet Archive, also based here in San Francisco.
Yep. Yeah. Aaron. I think collaborated a lot of different ways with the Internet Archive. And the Open Library wasn't an early, actually fairly soon after he left Reddit, he was involved with that.
And I also credit the archive for the Wayback Machine, which is the manner in which we hold people honest. We show what was up there before they purged a page. And this has come in handy time and time again, where you see people try to get slippery and change things or just delete a post. And it's often fascinating to be able to go back to a specific website at a specific point in time and see what was there and how it was altered.
Yep, I love the Wayback Machine. Actually, very useful tool. Really glad. It's great that the Internet Archive does that. It's funny because the Internet is this kind of record of our time and our culture, and yet it can change, and websites can go down, and can be altered, and dishonesty can abound. So, there's something incredibly valuable about the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine.
We're talking with Brian Knappenberger. He created the new film, The Internet's Own Boy, about the life and times of Aaron Swartz. So now let's turn to the legal problems that surfaced. Give our listeners a sense of what Aaron intended when he went to MIT and went into that utility closet with a laptop and copied the files of JSTOR. First of all, what the hell's JSTOR, and why does anybody care, including MIT?
Right. Well, good question. JSTOR is essentially this kind of repository of academic research. We're in this very, very strange thing sort of happens with academic research where, often taxpayer money or, money goes to these researchers who do this incredible work, kind of unlock some aspect of our world. They put their time and energy and talents and great minds to this research. And what happens is that they have to turn over their copyrights to these basically corporations. JSTOR is not the worst offender here. There's other offenders like Reed Elsevier. But what happens is that they have the copyright, and then they charge subscriptions to the universities, often the same universities that hire people in the first place, and to other people. You go to these places if you want to look at some of these articles, and you could easily spend $40, $50, $60, $70 on a single article. So if you're doing any kind of serious research, you can rack the bill up pretty quickly. So this is something. This locking away of the world's information and knowledge is offensive to some people, including Aaron. And so this could have been this at the heart of what he was doing. What he did was he got onto the MIT campus network, which is famously fast but famously open. Anybody can do it. You don't have to be a student. And from MIT, he had direct access to JSTOR. So he ended up downloading, he actually ended up downloading 4.7 million academic journal articles. He had authorized access. It's pretty clear that they didn't mean for him to download that many. But the question about what specifically he was going to do with them is unknown. He didn't do anything with them because he was arrested before he did. All these stayed on his hard drive. And the question, what would he have done, really, I think, baffled his prosecutors. They didn't really know. The main prosecutor at the time, his main prosecutor was Stephen Hyman. He had just come off a case that had made him really famous, which was the case of Alberto Gonzalez. Alberto Gonzalez is one of the most famous credit card hackers of all time, somebody who is obviously a criminal, somebody who is clearly motivated by a purely mercenary kind of motive. So this had made Stephen Hyman, had gotten him a lot of accolades. So I think they were really baffled. Why would somebody do this? Why would somebody download 4.7 million academic journal articles? Surely there's not a lot of direct financial benefit out of an 1860 Journal of Botany or something, right? People aren't going to pay lots and lots of money for that. So what was he doing? And so we look at the possibilities of what he could have been doing. He was quiet about this during his life. He didn't want to implicate people in his legal troubles, so he didn't tell a lot of people, talk about it. But we look at various scenarios. I think the silliest is probably that he was going to sell it. I don't think anybody takes that seriously. There's a potential that he could have posted these things. I mean, that's certainly true with what he did with Pacer. He put Pacer court documents online. But there's also the possibility that he was just going to analyze them for corruption in that research. And he did this with another database at Stanford called the Westlaw Legal Database. And at Stanford, what he did is he downloaded a bunch of these articles. He analyzed them for essentially for funding of these articles to, that might have led to biased results, so corruption in legal research. A really interesting kind of approach to looking at research, to seeing, especially when information does have so much power, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a pretty good case to be made. A couple of their friends sort of told me that without wanting to go on the record. Carl Malamud talks a little bit about it, speculates a little bit about what he could have been doing. But there's a pretty good, I came to the conclusion there's a pretty good case to be made that he downloaded these things, these articles, to analyze them for corporate corruption, specifically in the area of climate change. It becomes a really interesting, and by the way, this is the same thing he was studying while at the time in this kind of fellowship that he had at Harvard. This notion that you know, corporate funding gives you the results you want to know in research, and then you can kind of tout the fact that research has proved your conclusions right. It's pretty interesting. I don't know that, but I was told enough by enough people that that's what he was on to.
To put the JSTOR episode in context, is it the equivalent of going to a hoarder's house and finding that they have 1,000 overdue library books?
you mean on the part of JSTOR? I think the institutions that hoard are hoarders, and they hoard this knowledge, and it should be available to the rest of us.
Well, I understand your point, but I'm trying to contextualize the level of the crime, because my next point is that the way they tried to throw the book at him and the laws that they used to prosecute him suggested that he was worse than Chelsea Manning or Ed Snowden.
They really did. They really went after him. I mean, there's no question about it. What was the nature of the crime? I mean, I think it's important to note that none of it was copyright violations, right? That all the charges against him involve access to the database. So it became very, very tricky. Obviously, he could have downloaded less journal articles or downloaded them more slowly. And there wouldn't even be a case. I mean, there wouldn't be anything. We wouldn't even be talking about this. He had access through MIT to JSTOR. That was all legal. You know, clearly they didn't mean for him to download 4.7 million academic journal articles. So somewhere in there, they made a case for a crime, like a serious crime that was going to lead to a felony. You know, I don't know. Compare this to Stephen Hyman's own previous case where he was downloading, where he was actually stealing credit card numbers. Mm-hmm. And you realize the kind of absurdity of these laws, that they can be kind of used at will to go after who they want to go after.
Now, I want to pause in the narrative here a little bit about the court proceedings, because almost in the same time period, Aaron, who is compartmentalizing his legal problems, even from his love partner and apparently some of his closest friends, is nevertheless actively organizing and pushing to defeat the bad piece of legislation called SOPA, the Stop Online Privacy Act. And he really led that charge to victory. And so to see him able to do that at a time when he was facing all of these legal problems is quite remarkable.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, he's certainly in a kind of private legal hell that he's actively trying not to bring his friends into, or actually, I would say, even talk about in public very much. He did release at least one press release through a group that he co-founded called Demand Progress. But even that press release, which seems tame, angered the prosecutors so much that they told him, and one of the MIT kind of investigators, that he had started a wild internet campaign in his defense. I mean, I've made two films now about the internet and hacktivism and hackers, and I know a wild internet campaign. I've seen some wild internet campaigns, and that certainly wasn't one. Mm-hmm. So he was really, really keeping quiet about what he was going through on the legal sense, but at the same time, he was marshaling his own skills and the people that he knew to try to defeat this draconian law, SOPA. And he was incredibly effective at it. And really, a year after he was arrested is really essentially when that law was overturned, when a law that everybody thought was a kind of foregone conclusion actually died on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty high moment for him. It's striking, though, and we kind of portray this a bit in the film, that it's only within a year after that he's dead. He committed suicide.
Yeah.
So it really was striking, the difference between this public kind of crusader and this hell he was going through. And so, that's part of what we kind of look at and examine in the film.
You have a brief clip, too, where he asks questions about the National Security Agency and the surveillance of Americans. And that's an issue that I've followed quite a bit. I've interviewed many whistleblowers. But for the average person, until Ed Snowden surfaced, there wasn't any real hard proof of the extent of the unconstitutional actions that our government's been engaged in now for a decade.
Absolutely. You're right, there wasn't hard proof. I think that's one of the things that's been so effective about Edward Snowden, is that he brought forward these documents. And I think, but what is striking too in the film, we very haunting almost as a filmmaker, you're sitting in the editing room looking through archival footage, and I found this stuff with Aaron talking about the NSA about a year before Edward Snowden came forward. And, you know, we had some indications. There were whistleblowers at that time. William Binney had already come forward. Mm-hmm. Other folks, Thomas Drake and others, had come forward. Again, like you say, they didn't have the document. I think that did make a big difference. But looking at him, Aaron, being worried about this a year before Snowden, and also saying, you know, look, this has been a kind of slow progression that happened over time, going back to the Nixon administration, at least, and there's never been this kind of moment that really catalyzed it, that really kind of touched the spark, that really made people angry to realize that this is what our government was doing. And there was never a moment that happened, and of course, he just didn't live to see that moment. That moment happened with Edward Snowden, and it was about 4 or 5 months after Aaron had passed away.
And, Brian, at a certain point, MIT did agree to drop the charges against Aaron.
Nope.
Didn't they?
Sorry to interrupt. No. Actually,
oh, I thought
JSTOR,
they did.
JSTOR, who is really the alleged, quote-unquote, you know, victim in the crime,
right?
You know, the documents were part of their database. They are the ones that dropped the charges.
Okay.
MIT, but for some reason, the government marched on, and MIT kept helping them, even if when the alleged victim stopped. It's baffling.
Okay, so I guess I conflated those, because I thought JSTOR and MIT were essentially the same entity.
No. So basically, JSTOR is the repository of these documents. You could access them through the MIT network, and
mm-hmm.
that's where MIT got involved, is that Aaron used the MIT network to access those, the JSTOR. So
okay.
It became later a question of access, and so MIT had to give the prosecutors, you know, there's lots of little things that they had to do. They had to figure out what kind of monetary damage
mm-hmm.
had been done. So MIT had to come up with numbers that made it a X number of dollars, which made it more serious. Things like that. But really, allegedly, things were, again, quote-unquote, you know, stolen from JSTOR.
Mm-hmm.
But JSTOR realized pretty early that they weren't gonna pursue this. They didn't want to be a part of it. I don't think they were friends necessarily with Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
That's how Aaron's defense attorney phrased it. He's like, we're not friends. But they just, they sort of settled on very kind of very reasonable kind of terms and backed out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you believe the prosecutor kept going in part out of irritation that Aaron declined a plea bargain?
I do. Absolutely. I mean, I say that having talked to person after person who told me that was the case. I mean, You know, look, we give prosecutors enormous power in this country, and we get and the incentive they have is to notch convictions on their belt. This is how they get promoted. This is how they can later run for office if that's been their dream. It's clear that this particular prosecutor took it personally. You know, they wanted to break Aaron. I mean, this is what prosecutors want to do. They want to break their opponents, and we've given them as a society a tremendous leverage in order to do that. You know, people, and Aaron is in some ways an anomaly in that he had the money to fight it. He had talented lawyers. He understood the law better than most people. You know, this system of where prosecutors are given this much power churns through tons of people every day in the inner city.
And what was really hard to believe is that in September of 2012, they added 13 new felony counts. That doesn't compute for me.
Yeah, he was originally charged with four. So his initial indictment had four counts. And, you know, this is another one of these techniques that can amp up the pressure on somebody, kind of ratchet up the pressure on some defendant. They issued a superseding indictment, which increased those four. By the way, the four charges is also when they released the press release that said 35 years in prison and a $1 million fine. So this is what the government released at the time that he could face this. And so a lot of people try to figure out, well, how did they come up with 35 years compared to the charges and all of that? But then later, the government increased that to 13. So superseding indictment had 13 charges. You know, this is part of the tools that we give prosecutors. They can kind of do this. All they really need to do is notch one felony conviction. You know, a lot of times juries will try to split the difference and say, we like this person. We don't want to convict him on this, but we'll kind of obviously did something wrong. So we'll convict him on this. So all they're looking for is one. So this greatly improved the government's chances.
Well, Brian, I want to highly recommend your film to my listeners, and I hope that they will take the time and find a place to see it. Give us an idea of your distribution plan and how my listeners are scattered all over the country, some outside the U.S. So yeah. give us any source of information where people can find screenings or perhaps ultimately, you know, rent or buy a copy of the film.
Yeah, the film releases in theaters. I'm very excited about that. Nationwide, 25 cities in the United States on June 27th. And we're also doing, we're trying to distribute the film in a way that's kind of consistent with the kind of principles of Aaron. So we're going to go day and date, which means a video on demand. You can get it online same day as it's in theaters. You can buy the film if you want to support us, filmmakers, so we can keep making, angry films.
Yeah, where do we find you? Where's your website?
Well, you can buy it on iTunes. You can buy it on straight from us. The most direct way is through Vimeo, which we're actually releasing DRM-free with a Creative Commons license, since Aaron was an architect of Creative Commons. That's part of our distribution.
Okay.
So I have a feeling June 27th, take a look online. There'll be lots of places in order to buy it or see it, support us, or just try to understand what this powerful person was all about and hear the story.
Brian Knappenberger, thank you for joining us today, and thank you very much for making this film.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Be sure to look for the film The Internet's Own Boy, coming soon to a screen near you. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.